how are you? Let's see how we manage all of this. Essentially, the learning objectives for my presentation focus on three key areas, one being the development of outreach partnerships for addressing health disparities in the communities that we've been working with, looking at the communication tools that we use to focus on social change and behavioral change in any way that we can impact that, and taking a look at community demands and incorporating community demands into our message and our product. We will use the Celebra la Vida con Salud campaign, as I mentioned, as a case study to address these learning objectives. And so what is Celebra la Vida con Salud, Celebrate a Healthy Life? It's a national Hispanic health education campaign focusing primarily on the elimination of health disparities. And it incorporates certain key components. National health tour. This past year, we participated in 12 cities across the U.S. that have high Latino density. We've developed and produced a series of educational radio shows, both short program and long program format, that includes information about local access to resources and information on health disparities, chronic diseases that are impacting Latinos disproportionately. And a website, a portal that provides both information, again, resources, and connection to community resources. A crucial part of what we do is that we create a network of national and local partners, and so essentially we bring together the public sector, the private sector, community-based organizations, medical hospitals, medical schools, hospitals, federally qualified health clinics, and bring everyone together for the benefit of the consumers in different communities. So this is our seventh year. In addition to going to the 12 cities, we do special educational projects in the different cities around different chronic disease areas, topic areas. Just a little bit of background of who generally participates in the Celebra la Vida con Salud campaign, and primarily the festival tour is what I'm going to be talking a little bit more about. We're looking at somebody who's around 38 years old, is the average age. They're primarily Spanish dominant. Something crucial is that 38% have less than an eighth grade education, and the number escalates tremendously when we look at just up to a fifth grade education. What I'd like to, we're passing around some information, right, Vic? And if you just take a look, we attached an appendix. Appendix C, which provides information of the different cities that we have been visiting, and we'll give you a little bit of a picture of what the festivals look like when we go into the different cities. One of the things that we did, and just to kind of give you a better picture of who this demographic profile is, the folks that we've been working with, the primary people who participate in the Celebra festivals are foreign-born. And what we did is we developed an evaluation instrument that mirrored the CDC National Health Interview Survey, the NHIS, and actually the NHANES, but this information is primarily derived from the 2006 National Health Interview Survey. And what we find is that Celebra participants are less likely to be insured than even those reported on the 2006 NHIS. In effect, we have almost 70% total. In comparing also with the 2006 NHIS, we find that the population that we've been seeing is less likely to have a medical home. And one of the most troubling findings that we have in the cities that we visit is that there may be available resources locally, and many of this population, many of which are getting their information from primarily media sources, do not really understand what resources they may have available in their own communities. And so even people who may be in very close proximity to a federally qualified health center or a community clinic or an opportunity to get care and prevention, they just simply may not even be aware of it in their own communities. And that ties very closely to the fact that these numbers reflect not having a medical home. Just under half of the Hispanic men that responded to our questionnaire, which was worded the same, exactly the same way as the 2006 NHIS, claimed that they had a place usually when they were sick and needed medical consultation. The end his sample, of course, was a 23. And the same thing for women. And I'd like to show that the sample size included 1,151 women and 869 Hispanic men as part of the evaluation of the survey. Another important factor was time since the last medical visit. This graphic is based on the question where we asked participants how long has it been since their last visit to a doctor or the medical professional. Given the high rate of uninsurance and the lack of usual medical home reported in the last two slides, one might suspect significantly lower numbers for this particular chart. While recent medical visits are lower than we would like to see, over 50% of participating Celebra men and women report having been to a doctor within the last year. A caveat of this is, and we are doing further research, is that for many people, the interpretation of the questions, we of course are very specific with it, but for someone going to an emergency room and seeing a doctor there might have implied seeing a medical professional. And so there's a caveat to that number as well. When we look at the self-reported health status of the people who are coming, we find that they have a series of the incidences of chronic diseases that we've expressed concern about around health disparities, particularly when we look at high blood pressure, and some of the other numbers reflect high glucose levels and high stress in communities that we are working with. The first three of these, asthma, overweight, obese, and high blood pressure, conditions that they reported a health professional told them they had either. So it's not self-reported. They're reporting it to us, but a health professional indicated this to them. And so what we find in our communities when we visit these cities is that the levels of disease of uninsured and having a medical home are much worse than reported in the 2006 NHIS. And so then we, I'd like to share how we in our work then take a look at the model of approaching consumers and individuals in these different communities to take on working with and accessing the community-based services that exist and being able to get care. The Celebra model is based on something called Infórmate, Aprende, Actúa. And the idea here is that there's a, clearly we take into account in all of the communities that we work with a series of factors that become crucial to our understanding of the impact that we can have in communities. One is the recognition that environmental factors has a significantly tremendous impact on health outcomes. The same thing as the economic implications and economic investments that may exist in communities of color. So all of this taken into account, what we do is we build a model. We've built a model where we work very closely with the community-based organizations whose work is very direct service for consumers in the different cities. And so we work on a model of informing where we look at the community and provide information about health disparities. What do health disparities mean? What does it mean in the big picture for the Hispanic population? Then we ask them to take a look at what does it mean in their history? What does it mean in their reality? And we provide them with resources, both low-cost health care and free health care access, as well as connecting them to a medical home within their community's potential medical home. What we realize with our population is that media has a tremendous influence. And what we've done is we've taken every possible media outlet and utilized it to be a disseminator of health education messages, educational messages in terms of the diseases, and resources where people may be able to access services. And so we've partnered with big media, for example, Univision, Telemundo, all of the top radio stations across the country. And the idea is if you see one of our festivals, it looks like a fantastic party, and essentially that's just the hook to be able to disarm people to come in and have a dialogue around health, you know, improvement of health, accessing health resources within their community, and essentially kind of pressing, taking action. This is just kind of a little bit of our format, because what we do is we bring everybody together to this, and I'll use party as, you know, like a fun word. But essentially, we bring folks from the federal government, from the private sector, and we have an experiential and engaging opportunity to learn and to find resources beyond that day. I don't have a lot of time, so you know, I can share with you later the very specific areas that we focus on. We have a heart disease area. We do health education in HPV and cervical cancer. And our critical objective is that we are introducing this in a very disarming way, like I said, but making sure that people are connected to communities. These are some of our numbers. We're very proud of the fact that we provided almost 100,000 free screenings to folks that I have to tell you, some indicate this is their yearly checkup. Our objective is to push them to, you know, like I said, a medical home where they may be able to go beyond the time that we're there. These are some of the numbers in terms of their health behavior changes in terms of intentions, and this was also from our survey. And outcomes that we found from responses, and what we did is after the 3 months after each festival, we called the different cities, and they provided this information. The thing that's exciting to us is what we're trying to do, and we've created some very substantial partnerships with community-based organizations around being able to maintain continuity from the festival events that we do, and so we partner with these organizations to develop curriculum, continue to collect data, and to be able to provide an opportunity for people to keep looping back to services and to understand what services are available for them and their family. And as you can see, the health insurance issue obviously is a huge issue, coverage. I kind of stuck with my time. I'd be happy to answer when the time is appropriate any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. And our next presenter will be Dr. Christian.
Talk is cultural perceptions of symptoms of acute coronary syndrome and time to emergency room arrival. So let's take a look at the graph. This is the graph of New York. Actually, this is the map of New York City, and showing in the middle is the Brooklyn borough, and at the center, which is yellow in color, is an area which is called as Flatbush, and where we conducted our study. This area is very well known about diverse cultural population. I would like to actually focus on a little bit on the background of and the severity of the problem. Acute coronary syndrome is important manifestation of coronary heart disease, and it usually is the constellation of acute myocardial infarction and unstable angina. It is very concerning to know that 50% of the deaths, they occur within 1 hour of symptom onset and before even reaching to the ER. So this time interval from onset of symptoms to the arrival to the ER is very, very important to determine the morbidity and mortality of the disease. And because if you get treated within that 1 hour of golden period after onset of symptoms, you can definitely reduce the mortality of the acute coronary syndrome. So the time from onset of symptoms of acute coronary syndrome to treatment is very, very important, and it's called as delay. This time is breakdown in two parts, which is pre-hospital delay and the hospital delay. Pre-hospital delay is further composed of two parts, which is patient delay and the transportation delay. The patient delay is the main culprit here because it constitutes 60 to 70% of the delay portion, and several trials have clinical trials have shown that pre-hospital delay is the most important, which is actually we need to focus on, and because for the last two decades there has not been change in pre-hospital delay, and 50% patients, they still tend to delay more than 4 hours to reach to the ER. In spite of tremendous efforts taken by national health agencies and health organizations such as National Heart, Lung and Blood Institute, CDC and American Heart Association. The study which was done in 1992 in our area in Brooklyn, in the same area where we conducted our study, that time in 1992, the delay was 13 hours, and actually blacks, they delayed much more longer than whites. So so far there's actually there's not much data about whether or not these differences present among different cultural groups, and that's why we are interested in this topic, and we decided to do a study. And we actually we interviewed patients with confirmed or presumed diagnosis of acute coronary syndrome in the emergency rooms, and we also looked at the different time intervals and also the factor affecting those time intervals. So this study was conducted in two major institutions in Brooklyn, New York, in Flatbush area. And these hospitals, they serve culturally diverse population, patient population, and study was conducted for throughout from September 2006 to May 2007, and we selected patients based on the inclusion criteria, and we interviewed them in the ER within 12 hours of arrival to the ER with the study instrument. And the interviews were conducted by trained research assistant as well as myself. And how did we develop the study instrument? We actually referred to the survey instruments which were used in the prior studies, and we tailored the survey to our population. We did a pilot testing of the study instrument on the patient population, and finally, we used that study instrument for our study group. So here is the picture of our patient sample size. We had predominantly females and Afro-Caribbean patients. We screened total of 500 patients in the ER who came with the sign and symptoms of acute coronary syndrome, but only 391 patients, they were eligible and qualified for the study. So we interviewed them, and what did we find? So actually I will give you a nutshell about the demographics of this patient population. Majority of our patient population was economically challenged, and their household income was less than 5,000 per year. Majority of them, they had basic high school education. Only 20% of them, they had education more than 12 years. More than 60% of patient population, they had some kind of health coverage such as Medicare, Medicaid, or any form of insurance. So this, which is great because they didn't have any differences in, they had basic health coverage, so that was not the issue here. And it's very interesting to note that African Americans, majority of them, they were US born, while Caribbean, Haitian, and Hispanics, majority of them, they were not U.S. born. So they were actually foreign born, and they are immigrants. The most important cardiovascular risk factors such as hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, and active smoking, they were present in majority of our population. And as we know that these are the most important health, risk factors for heart attack, so which suggests that our population was really high risk for MI, and asked them about during the interviews, we asked them about how did they think their symptoms were related to, and they came up with different responses because this was the open-ended question, and I have listed some of the important common symptom perceptions we got during the interviews. It's very shocking to see that more than 60% patients, they didn't believe their symptoms they are related to heart, but they believed their symptoms were related to something else, such as gas pain, fatigue, stress, and indigestion. And it's actually concerning to note that 46% of Haitians, they believe their symptoms were gas pain. And if you combine gas pain and indigestion, which are in the same category, the number goes more higher, and it's really shocking to see that that the patients actually they are perceiving not to the heart but to the gas pain, and which can mislead them as well as mislead to the healthcare providers. So what did they do after this onset of symptoms? And you would assume that they would call 911, but actually, in fact, 5% patients only called 911, and the rest of them, they did something else, which I'll let you go through the slide. And when we actually looked carefully among the different ethnic groups, Afro-Caribbeans, they were most likely to drink herbal tea or ginger tea after they felt that their symptoms of heart attack. So we found differences among the different cultural groups, and how did these perceptions and their actions affect their time intervals? And actually, if you look at this slide, you will definitely see that they affected on their time intervals. And the red columns, the red bars, they show that this is the time from symptom onset to the departure, and the yellow bar suggests time from departure to arrival. The red bar is mostly on the patient depends on the patient decision. And you see Haitians, they delayed 14 hours, and the African Americans, they delayed 8 hours. So there are definitely differences among the cultural groups. But even though African Americans did much better than Haitians, it's still not acceptable because they didn't still come to the ER within that 1 hour of golden period. Also, time from departure to arrival, majority of them actually they took 2 hours to reach to the ER. And what is the reason behind this? What mode of transportation they used? And when we asked them what they choose to come to the ER, 30% patients, they only chose to come to the ER by ambulance, even though 50% African American, they came by ambulance, which is still not great, and most of them, actually, they came by private vehicles, and some of them, they also walked to the ER. We also looked at the discharge diagnosis after they were discharged from the hospital, and majority of them, they had a diagnosis related to their heart. And even if the patients, they didn't have a diagnosis related to their heart, they still are high risk population for heart attack, and they still need to understand about these symptoms and what actions need to be taken. So in nutshell, culture definitely plays an important role here, and it's very well known that racial disparity exists, but the disparities also exist among the different cultural groups within the same race, and we need to understand and incorporate these cultural issues in the health education intervention and campaigns. And so what we are going to do with this important information which we took from our study, so we are going to actually expand our study further, because we know that our most important limitation of the study is the small sample size. So we'd like to expand our study, and we are going to take this important message from our study findings to our community to educate them about their cultural issues, as well as how they would affect their healthcare outcomes. So and I would like to give my special appreciations to Dr. Judy LaRosa, who was my mentor, and also Dr. Michael Joseph. He is actually sitting in the crowd, who helped me in my study. Thank you very much.
Previously, community-based organizations have not been well integrated. organizations already having the network in place to really conduct outreach to at-risk communities. The symposium is divided into plenary sessions, which provided an overview of state and local planning to that point, and also featured a panelist of community-based organizations who described specific emergencies that took place in Massachusetts and how it impacted their agency and their population and how they addressed that impact. However, the real emphasis was on focus groups that were held in the afternoon, each focus group dedicated to the needs of a specific population. And there are behavioral health, the hard of hearing, homebound, the homeless, long-term care, mobility impaired, substance abuse, and visually impaired. And these categories were not to exclude vulnerabilities such as economic disadvantage or limited English proficiency, but rather were to reflect populations that would require continuity of health care in an emergency. Focus groups lasted approximately an hour and a half, and they were led by a skilled facilitator. The first objective of the focus groups were to identify what are the key issues in emergency planning that need to be addressed for their specific population. They were also asked to surface barriers to addressing these issues as they exist in Boston. And then a great emphasis was on developing concrete action steps that after the symposium they could take back to their agencies and implement in their emergency plans and their preparedness efforts. Each focus group had a recorder who maintained notes and captured the conversation, and upon the end of the symposium, this information was gathered together, reviewed. Additionally, interviews were conducted with the facilitators for clarity of items, and the information helped to create the development of an after-action report that was distributed to all participants as well as other relevant stakeholders in the state of Massachusetts. The report really organized the information into key themes that are experienced across groups. And we developed this conceptual model based from the information as a way to begin to think about how to address emergency planning and response related to vulnerable populations. The issues that the participants really identified fell into these key care consideration areas: risk communication, evacuation procedures, accessible shelter and care sites, and continuity of support services. The primary barriers that were identified were the fact that there are multiple populations with multiple needs, and it's difficult to offer specialized services in an emergency. Another huge barrier was, up to that point, exclusion of vulnerable persons in the planning process on planning committees. They're the experts. They need to be present to help develop these strategies. They identified as a barrier a lack of connectivity and coordination between the community-based organizations and also the response community. Really, to address this issue, these two different groups are going to need to work together, and that hadn't happened up at this point. And finally, community-based organizations said there was difficulty in planning continuity of their operations. They recognize they have a key role in emergency planning and response, but they're not sure how to go about it. They're not sure how they're going to sustain their operations in an emergency. This report addresses each of these areas in far more detail. I have several copies available. If anyone would like to have one, please feel free to take it. After we had the focus group, we with our partners discussed what was our next step. Something that we heard commonly at the symposium were alike from both the community-based organizations and also the response community was that they felt challenged by the diversity of needs, and they weren't sure how to begin to address this without clear priorities. So we discussed how can we move from the symposium to actually issuing recommendations and guidelines for community-based organizations. We decided to develop a survey that would actually validate the issues that were addressed in the focus groups as the issues that need to be addressed in the state and the city, as well as prioritize those action items that would have the most immediate and the greatest impact for vulnerable populations. The study population is very similar to the groups that attended the symposium: representatives of government commissions, the response community, community-based organizations, and also persons with vulnerabilities themselves would be represented in those groups. The initial focus is on Boston, but we're hoping to expand to the rest of the state. We decided to begin with risk communication as our first because it's an underlining issue in any and every type of emergency. As we generated the survey directly from what we learned in the focus groups, I just want to take a moment to describe some of those key themes. The first was that conventional communication mechanisms will not reach the majority of vulnerable populations, specifically persons who cannot rely on sight or hearing for information, for the homeless population who are very mobile and do not have access to technology sources, as well as the homebound population who has limited interaction with the public. They also said that there was going to be no one-size-fits-all approach. Groups use different sources of communication modalities. For example, the visually impaired, some will rely on Braille, while others will rely on text-to-audio conversion. Therefore, first responders are going to be trained in a variety of communication mechanisms, and they need to be able to make those available. Finally, they stated that vulnerable populations have much more limited access to preparedness materials than the general population. This is primarily just because there are limited formats of delivery currently being instilled, but also that the traditional content is not equally applicable to persons who might be described as more vulnerable. Generalized advice such as run, duck, and cover does no good to someone who possibly might be in a wheelchair. So really there needs to be specific content for specific populations. Some of the action items that they developed were assessing vulnerable populations to determine their preferred communication modalities, having responder trainings on communication technologies, and working with vulnerable persons. This is just an interesting picture that took place in Katrina. The officers are actually telling the persons to put their heads down, but they're deaf and they need to read lips, so they keep raising their heads to try to communicate that they can't understand what's being said. So there's a real need for training. Creating emergency messages with vulnerable populations and focus groups. Employing new strategies such as working with personal care assistants, radios for the homeless population, creating pictograms so persons can respond. The persons can respond with emergency responders. And finally, also just producing materials in a variety of formats. So we generated our survey, and just really quickly, I'll run through some examples of the questions. For one, the first question, conventional risk communication mechanisms, including television, radio, newspaper, internet, and emergency alert systems, are likely to reach your service population during an emergency. On a scale of 1 to 5, do you strongly disagree? Do you strongly agree? Another example of a question is, to your knowledge, do your community's first responders make personal preparedness and emergency response materials with content specific to persons with disabilities? Yes, no, I don't know. And we ask specifically for each first responder, for police, for fire, for public health, so on. Our next question is, for your service population, is likely to take the action recommended by the following persons in your community during an emergency. And we have a list of a variety of messengers. Government spokesperson, media spokesperson, a representative of faith-based organization. And again, we're asking for their opinion on a scale of 1 to 5. Do you strongly disagree? Do you strongly agree? This is trying to get at what are the best mechanisms for reaching vulnerable populations. And we ask, what's the best combination of mechanisms to relay information to your population group during an emergency? Generally, the survey is 20 questions, and it collects some demographic data and some data on agency characteristics, however, it is anonymous. Generally, the questions focus on appropriate mechanisms and methods for reaching vulnerable populations, what are appropriate messages or needed messages, and who are the best messengers. The survey has been validated by a group of persons working with specific populations on emergency issues and currently being administered via telephone interviews. Our next steps are just to complete the data collection and then to continue this process for the other issues as well. Following that moment, we're going to just convene advisory groups who will review the survey results and issue recommendations for planning. This is the formation of the Community Planning Toolkit with information that will be specific to Massachusetts, but we hope can be generalized across geographic areas. The toolkit will also include the surveys allowing communities to gather specific data about their populations and their needs. If you have any questions or would like more copies of the report or copies of the survey, feel free to contact me. Thank you.
They're recording this session today, and hopefully it'll be attributed to the right session. Like Mario said, the name of the presentation today is North Carolina Trimming Risk in Men Project, formative research to assess the potential for promoting cancer prevention in Black barbershops. The purpose of the presentation today is really to talk about the results from the formative research phase of the Trimming Risk in Men Project. I'll call it the TRIM Project for short. And discuss implications for cancer prevention and health disparities initiatives in Black barbershops. The TRIM Project is a two-year pilot study funded by the Centers for Disease Control through their special interest project mechanism. And the main aim of the project is to test the feasibility of training barbers as peer educators to promote informed decision-making about colorectal and prostate cancer screening among African-American men. It was designed in two phases. Phase one was the formative research phase, and in phase two, which we just completed, it's a pilot intervention trial. We did a group randomized delayed design with four barbershops in a county in North Carolina. I'm going to focus on phase one today, and hopefully in the near future we'll have results from that pilot intervention trial. Now, why are we focused on colorectal and prostate cancer screening? Well, as most of us know, the rates for cancer have declined over time, but there are still substantial disparities between white men and African-American men in terms of incidence and mortality. For example, we can see here the difference between the two populations for colorectal cancer incidence and mortality rates. We can also see the disparities here with prostate cancers, even more here. So why are we focusing on barbershops? Well, we started off with the belief that barbershops are a promising setting for health promotion programs among African-American men. And this belief stems in part from our 8 years of doing community-based participatory research in African-American beauty salons. And during that time, we frequently hear from our partners that we needed to do some programs for African-American men, and the barbershop, just like the beauty salon, would be an excellent setting for reaching that population. And frequently in our discussions with our partners about this issue, several things would come up about why the barbershop is important or a promising setting. Well, for one thing, African-American men make frequent visits to their barbershops, and they tend to see the same barber every time over a long period of time, and they tend to develop trusting and friendly relationships with their barbers. Also, barbershops are an important community institution, and they represent a safe social or cultural space for African-American men where they can talk freely about a variety of topics, including health. And it's also a place where social and cultural norms are constantly produced and reproduced over time. So if you're trying to address health values and health norms, it's a good place to start. Consistent with our community-based participatory research principles that we were using for these projects, we actually maintained and expanded our advisory board that we started with the Beauty Salon Projects. And this is our current roster right here for our community advisory board members. We do have one of the members from that board here, Al Richmond. Thanks for coming, Al. In terms of the research methods for phase one, we collaborated with our advisory board members, with owners, barbers, and customers from 8 black barber shops in Central North Carolina. We conducted owner-barber interviews. We did structured shop observations. We conducted customer focus groups and asked those participants in those focus groups to complete questionnaires for us. And we also conducted pilot barber training workshops. I'm not going to talk about the focus group results today, but I am going to talk about the results from the questionnaires that they filled out. One of my colleagues, Pam Diggs, is going to do a presentation specifically on the focus groups on Wednesday morning. And I encourage you to go see that because it's very interesting how we use the focus group results to develop the interventions that we tested in phase two. So I encourage you to go see Pam's presentation on Wednesday. Now the pilot barber training workshops, we're anticipating doing two campaigns, one for colorectal cancer and one for prostate cancer. The purpose of the study was to test the feasibility of training barbers as peer educators, so we had to do some training, right? So we wanted to pilot test these training workshops. We did two, and we evaluated those, and so I'm going to talk about the results from that evaluation. So what did we learn about the barbershops themselves? Well, the barbershops had been in business for several years. They have maybe a handful of barbers, not a lot of barbers, but it's pretty typical. They see quite a few customers on average on busy and slow days. You can see there's a lot of variability here. This is a small sample, of course, so a lot of variability makes sense. But as we continue to do our research in barbershops, we continue to see a lot of variability. And these numbers aren't that radically different than what we've seen in other data collection efforts. But there is a lot of variability. In doing our structured shop observations, we had our observers do record conversations that were occurring in the barbershops, and then afterwards we coded those conversations to see what they were talking about. And we actually recorded a total of 235 discrete conversations. About 12%, were related to health, and less than 1% about cancer. What do we learn about the barbers? The barbers have been working at their current shops for several years. They tend to see quite a few customers on any given day, and they tend to have a lot of repeat or return customers, people who keep coming back to them, like we suspected. There's a lot of variability there. In this initial sample, the average age was about 40, and about 45% had at least some college education. Now we asked the barbers to tell us, to what extent do you talk with your customers, and to what extent do you talk about specific health topics? We use a scale from 1 to 4, where 1 equals not at all, and 4 equals a lot. You can see that they tend to, be quite talkative with their customers, but they talk less about health overall. Prostate cancer was the one they talked about the most in terms of cancer topics. We also asked them about their comfort level with talking to their customers about cancer. The scale was 1 to 5, 1 equals not at all comfortable, and 5 equals extremely comfortable. And they were fairly comfortable with talking about cancer to their customers. They're most comfortable with prostate cancer. Now, what do we learn about the customers that participated in our focus groups? Average age is about 45. About 50% had some college or more. And quite a few of them the majority try to see the same barber on every visit. They've been going to their shops for quite a while. They visit the shops fairly frequently. And in fact, you see 80% were visiting every 3 weeks or more. But there was quite a few. The largest category was 2 weeks or more. So they're going quite frequently. And they also told us about, to what extent they talk with their barbers and about specific health topics on the same 1 to 4 scale. And the numbers are pretty consistent with just talking with the barbers, but they are a little bit less in terms of talking about health in comparison to what the barbers reported. We asked the barbers about what their preferences are for learning about cancer. How would you like to learn about cancer and cancer screening? The majority were interested in things like one-on-one training, reading pamphlets on their own, watching videos, and attending group workshops. This is good for us because the majority were interested in attending, in attending a group workshop, so we felt pretty sure that they would come to ours. We also asked them about their preferences for sharing information with their customers. You can see that, and I should make a point here, we were anticipating doing a couple different things in the barber shops. We were going to do the barber trainings, but we were going to have print materials in the shops like posters and brochures and pamphlets, that kind of thing. We were open to all kinds of ideas at this stage, too, so we were trying to sense out what we could do. I think it's important to note that the majority were interested in the top four, and those are all the kinds of things that we were thinking about. We were also thinking about the idea of doing videos in the shops, because a lot of barbershops have TVs, as you know. And there was significantly less were interested in doing that. Now, about the pilot training workshops, we did pre and post. So at the beginning of the workshops, we did a questionnaire, and then at the end of the workshop, we did a questionnaire. So we had pre and post workshop measurements. We saw positive improvements in knowledge about colorectal and prostate cancer from the beginning to the end. We saw positive improvements in self-efficacy to help customers become more knowledgeable about these cancers and about initiating those conversations about those cancers. We saw high overall satisfaction with both of the, with both of the workshops, and the majority of the barbers were likely to attend another workshop if it was offered. So, what did we learn about during this phase about barbershops? We learned that shops are relatively stable, busy small businesses with loyal customers who visit the shop regularly. However, I'd like to point out that you know, we saw a lot of variability in terms of how many customers they saw, how long they've been operating, that kind of thing. So I think it's important to keep that in mind, that some shops are going to be more stable than other shops. Some shops are newer. They may have less of an established customer base. So in doing interventions with barbershops, it's probably good to kind of learn a little bit more about the barbershops as you're recruiting them into your program. Talk is very common in the barbershops. You know, that's kind of the stereotype about barbershops, is that there's a lot of discussion going on all the time between the customers, the barbers, and it's a very dynamic social setting. Health and cancer were relatively uncommon, but that's to be expected. I don't think people spend a lot of time talking about these things. And so what we saw at this period before ever doing any kind of intervention is that it wasn't very common. Rather than a barrier, I think we saw this as an opportunity. And like, well, since they're fairly comfortable about talking about health, then we should be able to bring those numbers up as a result of our intervention. Barbers are interested and willing to learn about health and cancer prevention through a variety of means. So we can think about, well, what are the ways that we could engage the barbers, have them learning about these health issues, and then supporting them in getting that information to their customers. So I think they are willing partners in health promotion programs in their shops. And we also learned that the trainings produced increases in barber knowledge and self-efficacy, as well as high levels of satisfaction with the trainings. So we felt pretty good at this point about going ahead with our phase two, doing the workshops, and using those variety of intervention strategies that we were thinking about. I'd just like to acknowledge the Trim Advisory Board members for helping us in a lot of critical ways in developing and implementing the project. Of course, we'd like to also acknowledge the participating barbershop owners, the barbers, and the customers for helping us, for partnering with us and participating. We got our funding support from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention through a special interest project that was awarded to the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, the Center for Health Promotion and Disease Prevention. And also we had help from the UNC Chi Corps in developing the intervention materials. And this is also the research team at UNC. Thanks.
Will be Edward Mamory and Kathleen Rowe. and this is my colleague Ed Mamrie, and we want to take a minute to acknowledge some of the people that are in the audience who have participated in the thinking and activity that led up to this presentation. First of all, what a delight to see my former department chair, Dr. William Washington, here. Bill, can you raise your hands? People see where you are. Some of Bill's ideas and influence on us will be seen in this presentation. Also, you never know it, but the San Jose State people are sitting next to each other as they walk in. So Dana Hughes from the Student Health Service, she was very involved in some of the work that's going to be on here, Dana. And Janelle is here, Ariani, and Yumari Ruiz is a graduate. Janelle is a current MPH student, and Yumari Ruiz is a graduate of our program. And Ginger Smiley is one of our internship preceptors. All of these people have been really influential in the way that we think about diversity and inclusive excellence. We're really pleased to be at the end of this wonderful session, and we're going to take you now out of the realm of health care and preventive health into higher education to talk for a few minutes about a new idea in higher education. It's very new. It's just maybe the last 3 or 4 years that we think shows the influence of the work we've all been doing in eliminating health disparities on higher ed, but also gives an idea of some new ways from higher ed that we could be thinking about the work we do in health. So our goals are to introduce this concept of inclusive excellence as it comes from the world of higher education, to show the shift in praxis, which is a Freirean term of action and reflection and action, that occurs when inclusive excellence is the lens for looking at your organization and its approach and response to diversity. We'll give some examples from the San Jose State University MPH program and end with some lessons learned for eliminating health disparities and moving toward and achieving health equity. So just to give you a little bit of background on higher education today, if that's not where you've been spending your time, I'm a health educator by training and a professor by day, but over the last 2 or 3 years, I had the extreme pleasure to be invited to be the primary writer of our university's accreditation report for the entire university, and we were on the part of educational effectiveness, which is when I was asked to write, to lead the process and write the report, and one of the 3 essays that we chose to write on was on this topic of inclusive excellence. So there are a couple of things that have influenced the American Association of Colleges and Universities to be thinking about diversity and this new idea of inclusive excellence. One is just the plain fact of who we are in the United States and who is going to college. There's extraordinary diversity of people on campus in all kinds of programs, from community college all the way through postgraduate training. We are living in a changing world, and everybody in the university knows this. We can no longer prepare people for careers. We have to prepare people and encourage their process of thinking and adapting, because the world that they are going into will change so rapidly in ways we can't even imagine. It's a global world. It's a knowledge-based economy. People have to learn to think in new ways. Intentional and integrative learning is the buzzword in academia, and it's not just a silly idea or a trend of the time. It's a deep shift in the way that we help people, students, learn to think and react and reflect in the world in which they live, and the goal is for them to become empowered, informed, and responsible. There are, any of you in higher ed know that there are extraordinary pressures on the system right now to account for outcomes, some of which is a good kind of a pressure and a good kind of accountability, some of which is just horrible and narrow-minded and stupid. There's a new emphasis in preparing students to live in a changing world, and the reality that there are persistent gaps. Even though we are more diverse in our population, there are extraordinary gaps, just like in health. There are extraordinary gaps that can be characterized by key demographic variables, including race and ethnicity. Gaps in retention, gaps in graduation, gaps in success. And so the big aha in higher education has been that access isn't enough. It's not enough to just have a pipeline and open the doors and bring in as many diverse students as you possibly can, or even to bring in people from underrepresented groups. Something else has to happen, because people aren't being retained or graduating at the same rates. So that's moving from diversity to inclusive excellence. And Ed and I have a handout here with lots of references, as well as some of the specifics of these slides you can pick up at the end. But here's what inclusive excellence is. It's moving away from counting or enumerating people and differences to engagement with those differences, and engagement in 2 ways. One is engagement with diversity and difference as the subject of the learning in every possible way at every level of the organization. And then it's also making sure that we're collecting the outcome data that tells us appropriately about the experience of diverse people in our shared institution. And how is an approach to diversity different from an approach to inclusive excellence? An approach to diversity works towards access, towards getting people in the door. We focus on the outreach and the pipeline and support for individuals, personal support, social support, financial support. We have individual role models, and we work really hard to match people up with someone like them so they can be successful. We celebrate individual changes, and the indicator is success stories, the person who made it through, the one who achieved. Inclusive excellence assumes access and assumes diversity. That's where we're starting. And looks instead of following and tracking individuals, looks at and tracks the organizational and institutional changes that happen because of who we are, how diverse we have become. And diversity is the subject of learning. It looks then at institutional changes, and the indicator is group success. So four key questions then would be, what are the characteristics of our diversity? If you're approaching your institution from an inclusive excellence perspective, what are the characteristics of our diversity? Are success and excellence equitably achieved by all students? Is the campus climate perceived as being supportive by and for all students? And is diversity engaged in the service of learning so that students develop knowledge of groups, they develop intercultural communication skills, and the ability to contribute to a diverse society? That's the outcome from an inclusive excellence perspective. So our experiences at San Jose State.
So for those of you who came in, I'm the MPH program director, so I have the great pleasure and a great job in being the director of a program that really embraces diversity and has also embraced inclusive excellence. And I just really wanted to give you a few examples of how we operationalize inclusive excellence in really discrete activities and the way that our program is structured. I'm going to touch upon and give you more in-depth information on the highlighted characteristics in red, but how inclusive excellence is operationalized at San Jose State University. We have a mission, core values, goals, program goals, and that are really reflective of what inclusive excellence is. I'll be sharing some of that with you. We have a diversity statement that was generated by our students. In fact, Umari was one of the authors of that endeavor. We have an annual sexual diversity workshop, which I'll give you a little bit of history about how that came about. And we have a very active student role in governance. Students have an incredible role in the governance of our program. Things that I'll just mention, we have the minority training program and cancer control research, and it's recognizing that we really need to have more diverse people, people of color in PhD positions. And so this is a specific program in collaboration with UCSF to encourage minority students to pursue doctoral degrees. And I'm really happy to say we've had more than 30 students who participated in that particular program. And we have a course in multicultural communication for health professionals, which Kathleen Rowe is the instructor for. So we have a long-standing tradition of inclusive values and principles that guide our program, and this has really served us well. And so we publicize this in our admissions packet, it's in our student handbook, it's on our website. So students, applicants actually know before they come to our university what our program is about and what our shared vision is for inclusive excellence and diversity. So among many program goals and many principles, I'll just share with you some specific ones. One program goal, a program environment that honors diversity, civility, honesty, collaboration, engagement, respect, and ethical practice. We have a core value specific to diversity. Diversity is assumed, encouraged, celebrated, honored, and engaged, and very specific core principles of our program. Relevance and participation, inclusive and respectful language, collaborative, achievement. So I pulled real specific ones out from a whole long list of that. So this is from our students. So this is our diversity statement that we publicize on our website that is in all our MPH materials, and I'll just read through it. Our diversity honors experiences, visions, choices, and realities. It is open to varied cultures, classes, ages, genders, orientations, and abilities. It acknowledges differences and the sharing of the experiences, challenges, and contributions of those differences. Our diversity is built on tenets of respect, support, inclusion, and representation. It embraces and honors community, ethnicity, spirituality, sexuality, gender, and culture. Our diversity provides a philosophical outlook that searches to find the points of interconnectedness among us and accepts that not all points of view connect. Our diverse community resolves to create spaces for all voices and stories to be equally shared, heard, and embraced. And this was developed in 2000, and we continually refer to share with you how this came about. We had a student who was an out lesbian who actually shared with us that although the faculty on record, many of us, were really very open and to LGBT issues, but we weren't really doing anything about it. So from a personal perspective as a faculty member, we were very open. But what were we actually doing? And we were actually challenged to really think structurally of how we can contribute to making a place for this student and other LGBT students to feel safe in that structural environment. She felt invisible, she felt not acknowledged, and this is what happened as a result, is to be able to have a sexual diversity workshop each year. And the last one that we, the ninth, was with Cheryl Jacks, who was a two-term lesbian Massachusetts senator, and she came to speak at our university. So that just gives you an example. Our student leadership is composed of all of these really key elements, and again, the highlighted ones really directly feed into diversity and inclusive excellence. We have student co-chairs. We're a very small program. Everything that happens in our resource-poor program happens mostly because students generate the excitement of all of these particular activities. We have a convocation committee, diversity committee, global health committee, an MPH year committee, treasurer, communications and recognition, specifically curriculum review committee, and the peer mentor coordinators. So our program with shared governance, the previous slide really showed the student-centered and student-generated kinds of activities around governance. This is a slide that really describes the governance with direct interaction with the MPH program. So we're a program that's committed to inclusive excellence that integrates the perspectives, insights, and ideas of its diverse student body in all levels of organizational structure and culture. So we have students who serve on and have a vote on our MPH admissions committee to ensure we welcome the student perspective and insight. During curriculum review, one of the things, as those of you who are in academia, we're continually evaluating our courses. Our students really wanted us to look at, well, what happens in the middle of the semester? Why wait until the end? And what changes could we make to ensure the process of how the courses are happening? MPH core faculty meetings. For the longest time, we met at 10 in the morning. Our classes don't even begin until 3 p.m. And we had thought, well, students will come to our meetings. We invited them. No students would show up. So we, as a program, adapted. We have our faculty meetings now at 3 p.m. And so that was something that was really important for us, to have students actually attend our faculty meetings and actually have a say. And then also through their accreditation process. The ripple effect, that was MPH program. We're a small program. We accept only around 25 to 28 students each semester. The ripple effect to the college level, we've had actually an influence. We take an active role in the college level and Inclusive Excellence Institute. We had the college actually co-sponsor Cheryl Jacks, who was quite expensive as a speaker, so we got financial support to actually bring her. It was a great collaboration for the college to be able to do that. And with that, we had an LGBT university leadership lunch, which we invited representative people from the entire university. And then the student and faculty panel addresses the best practices for creating inclusive campus environment. We coordinated that panel. We had students serve on that panel to show how we did shared governance with the students. And also the college commitment to developing a diversity statement, that's in process. So they're taking our lead and hopefully our college website, from a college perspective, would be a welcoming environment for students to feel safe.
So I hope you see some of the ways in which you can take the concept of inclusive excellence and the commitment to making an inclusive environment, both through the data that we collect and the outcomes that we hope for, as well as the process within which we engage, and see the way the kind of shift happens, the transformative power of this idea. So our last slide is that this is what we offer from higher education, that if you take an inclusive excellence perspective, everybody involved in must assume diversity, assume that you have a diverse group of people, and go, and that's the starting point, to then articulate the organizational values and commitments that center inclusion rather than making it an add-on, that inclusion is at the center of everything that one does. And if you do that, then we need to listen to individuals and what they're saying about whether they are included or not, but act on the structure, not act on the individual, not send the individual for counseling or get within which we have responsibility and obligation, and adjust the structure so that individuals are comfortable and groups can equitably have a chance of success, and know then that the culture and the structures will change in ways that you can't yet imagine. Embrace what emerges, and then celebrate individuals, but track equity outcomes. It doesn't mean that we don't honor those people who do extraordinary things individually, but at the end of the day, what we need to see is everybody achieving in an equitable way. And as I say, we have our handout for you, and people are welcome. It has our diversity statement on it, as well as other things, and more background about our program and the way we operationalize this can be found at our website, which is on the handout. Thanks.
So there's a two-part question, right? One is, like, to what extent were there other health promotion activities going on in the barbershops? And the other one is what, you know, when we track the ultimate outcomes, are we also looking to see, was it the stuff in the barbershop, or was it your wife or mother or somebody, some other significant female in your life kind of getting you to go? The first part, I would say we avoided certain counties where we knew there was a lot of stuff going on. Al Richmond, who was here earlier, who's on our advisory board, is involved with the Prostate Cancer Action Network. I think that's the right name for it, more or less. And they actually have been doing a lot of stuff in barbershops in certain central counties in North Carolina. So we avoided those counties, actually. And what they do is a once-a-year screening event, and so they were already active. And we knew there were some stuff going on in Durham County, but we didn't work in that county. So we were trying to focus on counties that, one, had high cancer rates, that had some high African-American populations, had a high number of barbershops, and that we also felt like that there was a good, there was kind of a lack of stuff going on. So I guess that answers your first part of your question. We did see some stuff going on, like in some of the phase one shops, there was some, health department was distributing some information, but there they go and they put in materials and that's it, it's just drop off materials and then leave. And then in phase two barbershops, we saw some stuff going on with stroke prevention and stroke education, so there is some stuff going on. Now, about the difference between, is it the barbershop, is it our intervention getting them to go, or is it their significant female others getting them to go? We actually don't know about that, and we didn't inquire about that, so maybe we should do that the next time around. All right.
Getting to the doctor. So the question was, what's the proportion of foreign-born and in our university and in our work? At our we have extraordinary diversity in San Jose, California. We have been a majority-minority campus for over 15 years, and about almost 50% of our students were born outside of the United States. 65% say that English is their primary language, the language they spoke with in their home until five, and only about 30% say that they still are struggling to learn English. So we have extraordinary linguistic diversity as well as cultural diversity. And so in the university, that creates some really important data collection measures. Obviously, we can't just track the experience of Asians, for example. We have to track Hmong and Cambodian and Laotian and Filipino and Vietnamese and Cambodian and Hong Kong and Chinese and all of it. It's huge. Dana's next to you from the Student Health Service, and she's smiling because we know. So that's one of the ways in which, looking at inclusive excellence, you cannot be satisfied with traditional counting categories because it won't tell the story. At the end of the day, it's those outcomes that matter, and you have to develop data collection tools that track people and are sensitive to their experience and capture their experience in reporting and surveillance that's true to who they are and how they identify. We have a similar situation that's harder to play with, but we're trying around sexual orientation. How do you know the gay and lesbian and bisexual transgender population in your campus when it's not safe? Even in San Jose, California, it's not safe to be out, and not necessarily at all times in all contexts. And so how do you know the experience of a woman going into a bathroom? And how do you know what happens to her and whether or not her campus community is a safe place for her or whether she's spending the whole day not going to the restroom because of experiences she's having in the bathroom of our campus. And so we have to find ways that in our university we did it through the campus climate survey, again something Dana was involved with in trying to figure out the kinds of questions, the ways to ask about and draw out people's experience in ways that might be hidden and are not necessarily important when you're asking a mainstream person or someone for whom the culture fits, the institutional culture fits very nicely. You don't need to ask how many times have you been harassed in a bathroom, but you do have to ask it in an unsafe environment. You only know that that's an important question if you have people representing the diversity of your group in the planning and the data analysis. I neglected to say when I sat down, I saw that Frank Strona, who was our tech man, and we thanked him at the beginning, has also been very, very instrumental in all of this inclusive excellence work that we talked about, and he's been one of the people helping us think about how do you ask the right questions, capture the right data. I just thought of something as I looked at Ed. Another way that we do linguistic inclusive excellence. I thought about him in graduation. So here's a little tiny example of how we try to celebrate individual difference but make it something that's broad. It's a tiny example, but when our program graduates, when our department graduates, we have our own convocation ceremony, and our 50 graduates bring in, last May they brought in 600 fans. 600 people came to see 50 people graduate, MPH and undergrad. And we begin our ceremony for the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years we've been doing this. We begin our ceremony with a parade of people. They come up on the stage, the students, and the first student welcomes everybody in English. Welcome to our convocation. We're so glad you're here. And then one after the other, a person steps up to the microphone and welcomes in their original language. And every year we have at least 15, usually range from 17 to 20 different languages, dialects, and mother tongues in which people are welcomed. And that's an example of not just you know, celebrating diversity for a holiday or a potluck, but showing in our celebration, our biggest moment, everybody's language must be included.
The question is the community engagement part. Are we
so the communities themselves that were outside of the university, both the families, the communities where students come from, before recruiting and looking at the university and the faculty that have.
So as far as the admissions process, what we do is it's actually a really thoughtful process. So we have our criteria, and we're by committee. So we have at least two faculty members on the admissions committee, and then we also have a student that is represented. And so when we actually think about the MPH, because we're limited in the number of spaces, we actually are very thoughtful about the end. What is the end going to look like? In the end, 28 students will come, or 28 students. What is the diversity among that? What is their community experience? I think that that's what you're asking. And so what is their involvement? What are their different levels of involvement? And so we actually get the whole picture. And